Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the War Report. Today is our special Labor Day show, although tomorrow, of course, is Labor Day here in the U.S., and we are going to talk about labor, mostly the teachers' unions, and I'm going to give us a small introduction in the sense that most of you know that public education has been in a war for a very, very long time, throughout the 150 years or so that we've had public education. The current manifestation of this war, starting around 30, 35 years ago, has been the most sophisticated, comprehensive, and devastating war waged on public education, teachers, unions that we've ever experienced. So much so that I'm saying that today there is a gray cloud over our heads in terms of teachers as our profession and our unions. And we're going to look at the external and internal forces that are trying to destroy both the profession of teaching as well as our unions. And when I say external, I'm talking about groups that you've heard me mention before, like the Koch brothers, Alex organization, the Gates, the Waltons, the Eli Broad, and Obama, Duncan, and a whole slew of other powerful billionaires and multi-billion dollar corporations, both nationally and internationally. And when I speak of internal forces, I'm speaking directly to people who either run the unions in terms of leadership at national, state, local levels, members of teachers' unions who have different opinions about what the union should be doing or not be doing. There are internal forces that are just as powerful and potentially destructive as there are external forces. We're going to take a critical look at these forces as they operate today. That's the state. Our theme for the day is the state and fate of teachers' union in the wake of war, the war on public education. Joining me are my two co-hosts for this series, and there are going to be several shows throughout the next 2 months on this same topic. Dr. Lois Wiener, whom you know from having been on the show previously, and Miss Mary Compton out of London, England, whom you also know because she has been on the show previously. And to Mary, I want to say a special thank you because it's either 10 or 11 o'clock in London, and she's staying up to be with us on the show.
Thank you, too. That's fine. I'd just like to correct you on one thing. I'm actually in Wales and not London, but the time is the same here.
Okay.
Where I live in Wales, yeah.
And Lois, thank you, too, because it's, 3 hours difference in our time. You are in New York.
I am in New York right now.
Okay. So, Lois, introduce yourself, and then Mary, you follow.
Okay.
Well, I was a career high school English teacher on both coasts of the United States, and then got into the teacher education racket. My specialty has always been urban teacher education. And more recently, I'd say the last 7 or 8 years, I've focused on the global transformation of education, this global project really to destroy public education as we've known it. And Mary and I collaborated on a book some years ago, The Global Assault on Teaching, Teachers, and Their Unions. And so now I wear two hats. I'm a professor of education at New Jersey City University, and also I'm also an activist about teacher union reform and protecting teacher unions, both. So right now I'm wearing both of those hats. And I want to thank you, James, for inviting me onto this show.
You know, that's always my pleasure when you say yes. Mary?
Okay, so I've been a teacher in a local neighborhood comprehensive school in Wales for 30 years. I've now retired from teaching, but I'm still an activist campaigning against cuts and so-called reform education policy locally. I was the president of my union, the National Union of Teachers, which is the biggest teaching union in Europe. And I also am, like Lois, very interested in the global education reform movement. And as well as collaborating with Lois on the book she mentioned, I also run a website called www.teachersolidarity.com, which seeks to track the struggles of teachers and communities globally against the education reform movement.
And there you have it, people. We have today two of the most esteemed people covering this war on public education, and we have them coming from a global perspective. With that, let me start. Our unions here in the United States, we know that they've been under threat for almost forever. Corporations, rich individuals don't like unions. They rather have 30,000 individual employees as opposed to a union of 30,000 collective employees. And as a result, for decades and centuries, there have been all kinds of efforts to seriously prevent unions from organizing and becoming a union. Once the unions are organized and operating, to destroy the unions through legislation, through economic sanctions, you name it, we have had our share of problems in terms of trying to survive. As I mentioned earlier, currently, the last 5 years, last 10 years, starting back the last 30, 35 years, we have seen attacks on us that we have never seen before in the history of unions. Well-coordinated, well-financed, some of the most powerful people in the government and business and their minions are waging this war. Let's go and talk about some of the people that are waging the war. Those are the external forces that are trying to destroy the union. Anyone stand out for you, Lois?
Well, wow, that's a big question. The first thing is, I think we need to acknowledge that although this is U.S. Labor Day, this war is global. And it's being fought really ferociously by teachers and parents and students throughout the world. And we have a great deal to learn from them, a great deal. And Mary's website, teachersolidarity.com, is really an invaluable resource for us to use in learning about what's going on in the rest of the world and how we in the U.S. can defeat these forces. So You know, this is a very powerful international elite. They run corporations, they run banks, they run governments by buying politicians. So Joel Klein, former chancellor of the New York City schools, had lunch and dinner and breakfast with Elizabeth Gordon Brown. And Tony Blair, head of foundation, Mary, can tell us more about that. So, you know, these individuals are part of a global network. Bill Gates, one of the part of it. Murdoch is part of it. And sometimes when I say this, people say, wow, it sounds like a conspiracy. And we really need to get away from thinking about this as a conspiracy. It's a project. It's a project on which people collaborate. And they collaborate through institutions and through formal and informal networks. They get together at Davos, Switzerland. They get together at the World Bank. They're all together at the International Monetary Fund. They don't all agree on everything, but when you look at the networks, you see how the corporations are intermingled, and the people who head those corporations collaborate and talk with one another and plan with one another. So Pearson is implicated. Pearson Publishing is really implicated in a lot of the textbooks, and also something that I just learned about at the National Union of Teachers Conference in May. Maybe Mary will talk more about that. This terrible project in Africa that World Bank is involved in. So it's a network. It's a network of individuals that's funded by extraordinarily wealthy, powerful people. That's what I would say. And they have an agenda that they're imposing on practically the entire world.
Barry, before you answer that question, yes, Pearson is the largest entity probably going, in the sense that not only do they handle testing, curriculum, publish textbooks, the whole nine yards. They have almost complete control of that area of education. And, yes, they are global and they are huge. But here in the U.S., I mean, they're huge here in the U.S. Back here in Los Angeles, I want to get off topic too much, but Pearson had cut a deal with the superintendent of L.A. Unified School District to provide testing and curriculum materials for the school system, along with the Murdoch company. Was it Murdoch? I'll take that back. It's Apple, or, yeah, with the iPad.
Apple.
Providing
exactly.
The
yeah.
Apple.
It's Apple.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Apple providing
yeah,
the iPad.
We have Bill Gates, Microsoft, and we also have Apple, right?
Yes.
So we
those
have
are the
two
big
corporations players. That are competitors, and yet they're collaborators.
Absolutely. Then you throw in Eli Broad, you throw in the Waltons, the whole family, and they're, I don't know how many billion dollars, I think they're worth over $100 billion something collectively, supporting charter schools, vouchers, privatization period, and you throw in, as I mentioned earlier, the White House, Obama, 100% pushing privatization, turning his back on unions and teachers, Duncan, his minion, pushing race to the top. We have these humongously wealthy, powerful external entities, and not to mention their minions, the Michelle Rhee, who is on a descent as a power broker for that side of the war, and she's being replaced, I guess, by Campbell Brown, as a new face of the opposition. These are some, as you said, they're connected through finance. Well, they're connected through two things: their enormous wealth and power. Mary, you go with that question.
Okay, so, I mean, to start off with Pearson, I think it's important to understand quite how global they are. I mean, their sort of education arm operates in 70 countries around the globe. Their education revenues in 2013 were $7.3 billion globally. And Lois is quite right that some of the things that they're involved in, well, most of the things that they're involved in are, you know, from our point of view, destructive. But to give the example that she mentioned, which was, I think she was referring to the school-in-a-box scheme in Kenya,
right,
where a chain of so-called low-fee private schools is supported by Pearson. They charge 65 cents a day for a child to go to these so-called schools in a box. It's the box has kind of lessons pre-prepared. They're delivered by untrained teachers earning practically nothing. And when I say practically nothing, I'm talking about probably a couple of dollars a day. It costs, as I say, 65 cents for a child to go to that school. When you consider that nearly half the population of Kenya exists on less than $1.25 a day, then you can see that, you know, 65 cents is a massive part of their income. And for that, they get education in a tin shed with no windows, from unqualified teachers being paid peanuts and delivering sort of shrink-wrapped lessons. That's just one example of Pearson's activities globally, but they have a much more sort of macro-level function or ability to affect things. So, for example, their education advisor, Sir Michael Barber, has been advising the Pakistani government about how to improve their education, and surprise, surprise, improving their education involves data collection, it involves performance-related pay, it involves privatization, it involves the whole gamut of what we have come to call the global education reform movement or neoliberal reform. I don't know whether you want me to talk about what's happening specifically in the UK about this attack on public education and unions. Would you like me to talk about that?
Yes, please.
Okay, so in the UK, since the time of Margaret Thatcher, really, there has been a major attack on all trade unions. In terms of education itself, this whole neoliberal reform stuff has been becoming more and more entrenched. It was started by Thatcher. It's been carried on by Tony Blair with great enthusiasm, even though theoretically he represented a party which was actually founded by the trade union movement. And it's now, of course, being taken even further by the right-wing coalition government that we have at the moment. So, for example, the so-called Academies program, which was started by Blair, was a sort of copying of the charter school system, more or less, in the US. And academies don't have to follow school teachers' paying conditions. So that's a major attack. That's national paying conditions. They can set their own paying, which is a major attack on trade unions, because obviously then suddenly from being able to bargain on a national level, suddenly you're having to bargain school by school. And these academies are schools are forced to become academies by our very draconian inspection system. And academies are to take over by some corporations or by sort of corporate responsibility, like private equity funds, or there's a group called Harris Carpets, for example, which is, as its name suggests, is a carpet manufacturer, and they have taken over a number of schools and run a number of schools. So this is a major attack both on equitable public education and on teachers and on teaching unions. So, we learned from you, to be honest. I mean, I think it all started, didn't it? Partly in Chicago, then in Chile, then Reagan and Thatcher got together and had a great love affair. I mean, not literally, do you know what I mean? Perhaps a great love affair with neoliberalism, and, you know, the rest is history. We in England in particular, and I have to say that I'm talking here about England rather than Wales or Scotland, have been saddled with that system ever since, and it is getting worse and worse.
Okay. I got to do a little bit of housekeeping here. I want to give out our toll-free call-in number. That is 888-627-6008. Let me repeat. This is a toll-free number, and you can call in. You can talk to Lois, talk to Mary, and if you also want to, you can talk to me. That number again is 888-627-6008. And I encourage you to call in and talk to our guests. These are some of the most iconic people in the education community globally as well as locally and nationally. All right. Now, any more external threats that can really wreak havoc on us? When I say wreak havoc, I'm talking about surviving, which we'll get to at the latter part of our hour. Before we get into the internal forces, any other comments on external?
Could I say something? I just want to say something. Go on, you go, Louis.
Let me jump in and just say something that we've been taught, and I think it's important for us to, while recognizing the enormity of this assault and the power of the forces arrayed against us, I think it's very, very important that we also see the victories that we've had. And one of the victories that we had, I'm looking right now at a little red and white button that I picked up at the NUT conference in May, and it says, Gove must go. So Gove was the Minister of Education, and the NUT conducted a series of one-day strikes and organized with parents against the ministries. Terrible education policies, and you know what? Gove has gone. Now, of course, we haven't totally swept the Ministry of Education free of the toxic policies, but enough bad publicity and enough bad publicity was generated. Serious education of the UK public about what was going on in the schools, that Gove had to go. He became a liability. And we're seeing the same thing now in the United States with the pushback about standardized testing and Common Core. And there is absolutely ferment in teachers' unions globally. Lots and lots of teachers are saying, we want a different kind of union. We want unions to protect us and to protect public education. So in the midst of talking about these powerful forces arrayed against us, I think we also have to see that those powerful forces arrayed against us are helping to create a new movement, a new social movement of teachers.
Can I just jump in there
absolutely.
And say something?
Yes.
Can I just say something
please.
About the World Bank here? Because this really ties in with what Lois was just saying, which is that the World Bank, in some of its reports, says quite clearly in terms that it sees teaching unions as one of the main, as they put it, blocks to reform. So they recognize that one of the forces, which is likely to be a block on their road, are the teachers' unions. And they're right. They're right. They're right to recognize that. I mean, I was, for another article I was doing, I was counting up from my website how many countries in the world over the last 12 months teachers have been taking strike action, usually, or major protest action. And on my website alone, I covered 65 different countries where such things were happening, mostly in the global south, although obviously in the global north as well. A huge number of teachers internationally have been taking action on issues like privatization, high stakes testing, you know, punitive accountability measures, low pay, class size, and so on. And, you know, it's time, in my opinion, that our global union federation really, which is called Education International and which represents 30 million teachers globally, it's time that it really concentrated its huge resources on supporting that struggle and, in my opinion, turned in a democratic way to its membership and, instead of collaborating, in my view, with the World Bank, for example, over a thing called the Universal Learning Metrics Task Force, which EI sits on and which is chaired by somebody from Pearson, I think it's time that Education International turned its attention and its considerable potential power wholly towards the struggle of its members globally against, well, in defense of public education and against, you know, this destructive power of the corporations. And I do believe it's beginning to happen. I do hear that EI is beginning to turn its attention to Pearson and so on, but it must also turn its attention to what its members are doing globally. And in my opinion, from what I see on the website and so on, that's not happening.
Here in the U.S., we are also seeing the rise of grassroots organizations and some unions, local unions, rising up and taking a stance of no more from the privatizers. In the area of high-stakes testing, we have a group called Opt Out. Peggy Robinson is a person very, very involved with that. And I've talked to her while I've communicated through email with her. And I know they've had tremendous impact. And it's they have units all across the country, and they're growing. Lois, the organization that you and I share a membership in, the Badass Teachers Association, 51,000-plus members, we are getting more organize and focusing our potential influence and on specific issues and individuals, particularly Ernie Duncan, to name one right at the top of my head. There are so many other small groups in different states, different parts of states, that if we can organize on a national basis here, like you guys have done in Europe, we have enormous political and economic potential to use against the privatization group. Okay. Now, I want us to take a one short 2-minute break, and then we will be back. Okay, we are back. First things first, I understand that if you are trying to call our toll-free number, that line is down, so we cannot get any calls coming in. As a backup, both Lois and Mary are on Twitter. You know I'm not, because you all know that I'm like a Neanderthal when it comes to modern-day technology and social media. I admit it all the time. So Lois will give everyone her Twitter handle, and then Mary will give everyone her Twitter handle. feel free to blast questions to them, and they will try and we'll answer the questions if you have them. Do you want to go, Mary, and give your handle?
Yeah, mine is at Teach Solidarity.
At teacher, at Teach Solidarity.
No, just at Teach Solidarity, because you couldn't get the ER in, it's too long, so it's at Teach Solidarity.
Oh. At Teach, okay, Solidarity.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
What the hash mark or whatever they call it? Hashtag
yeah, the
or
hash,
whatever?
No, well, no, the at the beginning. Yeah.
Okay. Well, people, they will know. I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about. Okay, Lois?
Mine is at Dr. Lois Weiner, all one word, LoisWeiner. And I just tweeted invitation to people to tweet back if they have any questions.
Okay.
So as they come in, I'll report.
Interrupt. Yeah, interrupt, and we'll go to it. Okay, Mary,
yeah,
I'm going to come back to you.
Right
to...
now.
Go ahead.
Go on. Mary wanted to say something about the Teach For franchise that I think it's important for people to know.
Yep.
Yes.
I was just going to say that I don't know whether people realize in the U.S., but Teach for America isn't confined to America. That Wendy Kopp's franchise extends to, I think now, about 35 countries. So the idea that totally untrained people or people who've had a minimal amount of training are then put into classrooms in low-income schools is happening in many parts of the global south as well as other countries in the north. So, for example, I've come across it myself when I was doing some research in Mumbai in India, where Teach for India was working in this public school that I was researching in. These were people who were taking a two-year break from a blue-chip job, so mostly they were sort of bankers or business people. Excited young people. You know, they were doing their best, but none of them had any idea that they were going to carry on teaching after two. When I suggested that to them, they just looked at me as though I was mad, because salaries in India for teachers are approximately about $100 a month. Well, you know, there was no question that these people were going. Some of them were going to stay in education. Most of them were going back to their banks and so on, but some of them were going to stay in education, but in education administration, to propagate these same ideas throughout the public school system. So, you know, I just wanted to point, it also exists in my country, Teach First, it's called here. I just wanted to point out that this Teach for America franchise is a global, is one of the external forces that you, Dr. Miller, were talking about at the beginning of the program.
Yes, I'm aware of it. I think I've mentioned it in the past, but thank you for bringing that up, because that is a global force that is operating under the guises of someday taking over all teaching responsibilities globally under a privatized system. Thank you for reminding us of that. Lois, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I did want to say something. You know, I think that those of us who are insiders to education, and that's, I think, I say that objectively, and I'm proud of being an insider, because I've been a teacher or a teacher educator my entire life, with the exception of 2 years when I worked in marketing and made slip covers, but to support myself while I was in graduate school. But you know, a lot of people don't understand what's wrong with destabilizing the teaching profession in the way that the Teach For franchise does. And I think that it's important to say that it's important for people to understand that schools need a stable, skilled workforce, and that one acquires the skills that are essential to being a really fine teacher only after 3, 4, 5, 6 years. And so the goal of policy should be to retain teachers. It shouldn't be to churn. And the policy of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the Teach For franchise is to churn, to put people in, to have them teach a couple of years. It's okay if they get burned out because they're going to leave. And we can't sustain a quality public school system with churning. And that's the reason that really elite private schools, that these powerful elites send their kids to, or public schools that are much like private schools. There is a wonderful article in the New Yorker describing the conditions in this public school system in Silicon Valley, where the silent auction of parents was for things like a week getaway in the islands that was $3,000, you know, so parents are reeling. It's a public system that's really privately funded. And those schools that serve the children of elites have a very stable, well-educated teaching force, and they have small classes. And that's what we want for every kid. That's what every single child deserves, especially kids who most rely on education as a vehicle for social mobility. And I think that we have to explain that to make that case to parents that this churning is detrimental to their kids, that teaching is a skilled occupation, and we can see that in the fact that the wealthy send their kids to schools that have a stable teaching force. So I wanted to add that.
Oh, okay. Turning to the internal forces, let me tell you what I'm talking about again. First of all, there's something like almost 5 million teachers and two national organizations. National Education Teacher Association and the American Federation of Teachers. One group has 3.4 million members. The other group says they have around 1.5, 1.7. So totally, we're looking here at 5 million plus membership. We're talking about two national organizations that have operations in all 50 states. We're talking about local units that have membership anywhere from 30, 40,000, possibly more, most often less. State organizations have 100,000, or in case of New York, I think it's over 600,000. In California, it's over 300,000. We're talking about quite a large number of people. And when I talk about the internal forces and how these internal forces could be operating to disrupt and also destroy, think about any large population. You're going to have people with different opinions, different viewpoints, different values, levels of intensity, levels of commitment, and et cetera, all trying to vie for getting their point of view over, getting what they want done first, and et cetera. I'm going beyond that kind of group dynamics and looking at let me go back and just say both national organizations have their national conferences. This year, the National Education Association had a conference in Colorado, and the American Federation of Teachers had theirs here in Los Angeles area. Weeks, couple of months prior to each of these organizations holding their national conferences, there was a firestorm of union members expressing their frustration, their anger, their bitterness against their local or their state or national unions. There were people who were combating these negative, what they call negative comments, and et cetera, or you can call them the traditional supporting union leadership, regardless of which way they're going, and you have the insurgent groups who are now deciding that they don't want the union to go that way. They want to vie for power so they can move the union in different directions. I mean, it was a firestorm of comments. I logged as many of them as I could. I categorized them and et cetera. And what I came up with was the idea for this show, The State and Fate of Teachers Union in the Wake of War. What is this? The impact of this war on the unions themselves, this tremendous effort to crush us, what has it done in terms of fueling our own differences and putting our members at each other's throat to some extent, and et cetera? And Lois, your piece this summer, The Trifecta, was right on the button, the pulse, should I say, of what I was seeing through the internet for almost 4 months, and now even more so. So I say that there is a real threat internally to our survival. Do you, any one of you, agree with me or disagree with that?
Well, I would put it differently, James. I would say that I'm actually more hopeful, because I think what we're seeing is a contestation of ideas. And we haven't seen such a pointed contestation of ideas in many, many years, maybe ever, in the history of modern teacher unionism in the United States. And I think that's really the case in the global north as well, that the generation that built the unions in the 60s and 70s, when they won collective bargaining, at least in the global north, that they built the union on the basis of a service model. And that idea of what a union should be and has to be is being contested. Now, is that a threat? No, I don't think it's a threat. I think it's only a threat if one views the union as being the leadership. And that is a threat to leaders who view themselves as being the union, but it's not a threat at all to the union. And I think that what's really interesting is that increasingly people who are in the leadership of union locals and national unions are in the global north are understanding that the status quo is not sustainable. So they can view this movement to transform the unions as an ally, or they can view it as an opponent. And I think increasingly they're adopting the rhetoric of this movement that's emerging to transform the unions. They're adopting the rhetoric. The problem is you cannot democratize a union from the top. They can't democratize the union from the top. A union can only be democratized and built from its base. And so the question is, how are members going to hold leaders' feet to the fire in terms of struggling against this project? That, to me, is the critical issue. So how are union members going to hold the leadership's feet to the fire in really defending the union's ideals of solidarity and defense of public education? And there are conservatizing pressures that any union leadership experiences. It doesn't mean that they're bad people. It doesn't mean that they don't have good intentions. It means that they function in a milieu that's different from the milieu that one functions in as a classroom teacher or as a union member. And it's our job as union members to continually push to have our leaders defend what we know is best for kids and for public education. So I don't see it as a threat. I see it as a contestation. And I think that contestation is very healthy and very necessary.
Mary? Mary?
Yes?
Okay, am I still on?
You are. Everybody is still on.
Okay.
Okay.
We have a little... Okay, Mary, are you there?
No, Mary is not there. I've got to bring her back.
Okay. Oh, okay. Folks, we're having a little connection problems with Mary in Europe. So I'll wait for a second or so before we move on to... Well, let me go back to what I'm seeing, Lois.
Yeah.
It's so much. I'm trying to think where I should start here. Let's start with union members who become former union members filing suits against the union in Michigan, in California. That's a threat. That's adding to the external forces' push to destroy the union. What about in New York, which is your territory, and you know more about this than I do, the, I'm going to call it conflict, you can call it whatever you want, between the, what is it, Moore, and was it United? Okay, will you give us...
The Unity,
okay.
Unity Caucus in New York
City. Unity, I'm saying Unity. They're clashing,
yeah.
Of course.
Well,
we had the clash in Chicago,
yeah,
with CORE. Here in Los Angeles, we have Union Power taking over. We have members who are very, very upset both with Union Power and the administration that it succeeded, and that they were not sticking up for teachers who are being thrown in what we call here teachers' jail.
Right.
There are people,
right,
who, in New York, who are very, very upset over the same thing. Teachers have been thrown in the rubber room, languishing there for years, losing their credentials, and et cetera, under very false pretense, and et cetera. And so members are mad at, I'm going to say pissed off, with leadership. To me, even, and also the top-down nature of the national unions in terms of how they control so that they stay in power. And people talk about being off and starting new unions, but they're fairly tired of what's happening.
That's actually coming from your end.
Okay. Mary, are you back?
I am, yes. I wanted to say,
yeah,
I missed a bit of that, but I just wanted to say that this you know, this longing for democracy in unions isn't confined to the North. I mean, you only have to look at Mexico, where the union is totally corrupt, the FMTE union, and where really
right.
brave people have fought to construct their an alternative or a section of the union democratic, and have faced, you know, have joined with local communities and fought a tremendous fight in places like Oaxaca, for instance, you know, occupied central squares and so on. I've actually been attacked by sort of goons sent in from the union headquarters. And to give you another example, Egypt, where before the so-called Arab Spring, Egyptian teachers were forming their own union in defiance of Mubarak, who, you know, the union before that was, you know, a union that belonged to the state. So, and of course, you know, lots of things, if lots of water's gone under the bridge since then. But nonetheless, this kind of longing for democracy, longing to have a voice within the union, isn't at all confined to the North. And I also just wanted to say that in terms of my own experience as an activist, I think that the present attacks on schools, on, you know, the cuts that are happening, school closures, all of these things are energizing, actually, you know, paradoxically, are energizing young people to come forward to take this is something that I've, you know, as an older activist, something I've been desperately wanting for a long time, and at last, you know, young people are coming forward and saying, hang on, you know, I want to be involved in this fight. So I think, actually, oddly enough, that it's a very hopeful time for trade unions, because I think younger activists are going to come forward and are not going to put up with, you know, the kind of politic squashing that has happened in the past. I have to say that my own union is a lot better than it was when I was president. You know, it's become much more democratic, and I think it's continuing along that line. And so I'm actually quite hopeful about developments, as I think Lois was saying as well, about developments within the teaching union movement, both here and despite the, you know, massive problems in the Global South, as well.
Lois, yeah, you wanted to say something?
I want to jump in. I want to say that Mary is really right about, you know, the Global North and Global South are very broad brushes. And the British Columbia Teachers Federation is in the Global North, but I think it's done a better job than most unions of sustaining its sustaining a democratic quality and culture, a mobilizing culture. And so, on the other hand, in Mexico, you have a state-controlled union, very corrupt, in which you have a magnificent democratic movement challenging that. Honduras, though, is a very different story. You have a democratic union that's really mobilized as a political leadership in the defense of democracy in the country. So Global North and Global South are very broad, and I'm glad that, you know, Mary brought that in. I do want to say this, though, about these tensions within the union. We have a new generation of activists, and we have a movement emerging. And when I am in contact with activists, the advice that I give them is to form a caucus, because a caucus is the democratic nucleus of what you want the union to be. So the caucus has to have democratic operating procedures, and it has a program that it announces publicly. It invites everyone to join on the basis of those principles. And that is exactly what CORE did in Chicago. And that's the reason that when CORE was elected, it had a mandate. It had a mandate and it had a base, because it organized at the school site on the basis of principles. And for whatever the reasons, that's not how things play out in every city. It's just not the way they play out. And it didn't play out that way in Los Angeles. And I think that nonetheless, although I wish that union power had formed itself as a caucus, as a new caucus, and not just been a slate, nonetheless, I think that's a leadership that should now be supported. And that doesn't mean that it's supported uncritically. It means it's a leadership and it's a union that should be supported, because the election was run fairly, and the union power slate won the confidence of most of the people who voted. Now, the idea that we can form a different union, I mean, that's called decertification. It's very tempting to people. I have to tell you that in my own local, because I was involved in forming a rank-and-file caucus, people talked about that all the time. Well, we should just decertify the old union. And I think that plays into the right-wing attacks on the unions. Now, what we need to do is we need to struggle to transform the union. We have to struggle to democratize it. In the United States, in the AFT at least, were covered by federal regulations about how elections are run. And I think that it's, while we want a union leadership that sets out a course and is courageous and has a vision, at the same time, we can't expect that the union leadership is going to do it for us. We have to do it ourselves. We have to do it by bringing a set of principles that we believe are going to save public education and protect the profession and protect kids to teachers and educate, organize, and mobilize. That's it. There's no shortcut. There aren't any legal shortcuts to that. And I think that I don't want to romanticize where we are right now, but I do agree with what Mary said, that we are in a moment when teachers realize that the profession is really threatened with its very existence, as is public education. And people are frightened, they're angry, and they're also looking for answers. And that's the reason that shows like this are so important, because it puts the problems on the table and it starts the conversation going. So I'm going to have to go, but I want to thank James so much for inviting me, and to say that it's always great talking with Mary, and I advise people to look at her website, because she just did a brilliant blog about a book that was just out. Totally brilliant. So thank you both very much.
Today, we are going to be in the state of Michigan and the city of Detroit. And for the regulars on the show, you know that's where I was born and raised, went to school there, and still have great affections for my city. And so today's show is a little more personal than all my other shows. So with that, we have a stellar guest list today. And I hope I can do justice in terms of introducing them. But if you hang in here, when you hear their stories and the things that we're going to talk about and what the people are going to be able to provide insight on, you will agree this is a very special group today. I'm going to start with Dr. Pedroni, Thomas Pedroni. He is a professor, associate professor of curriculum studies and policy sociology, and director of the Leonard Kaplan Education Collaborative for Critical Education Studies at Wayne State University. I don't know if you guys remember, but that's my alma mater. I got my PhD in the hometown university. He also directs the Detroit Data and Democracy Project. He can tell us about that in a moment. But he's best known for a book that he recently published called Market Movement, African American Involvement in School Voucher Reform. That book won the 2009 Critics' Choice Book Award from the American Education Studies Association. That's a book that I have on my wish list. He already knows that, and I'm waiting for the price to drop so that I can buy it and review it and have him on and we talk about it. We have also a Miss Helen Moore, who is the chairperson of the, was it, Vote No on Takeover of Committee. I've just botched that. She can clear that up for us. And she and Rosa Parks filed a joint lawsuit against the state of Michigan. At the time, the state of Michigan was the first state to institute a takeover of a school district in 1999. Mrs. Moore has been fighting for equal education in Detroit, and particularly for the black families in Detroit, for over 45 years. I called her a senior icon in this war on public education. And we have Elena Hutrada, and again, I may have botched that. You know me, I'm not very good with names. She is a longtime community and union activist. She has had the opportunity to work with Cesar Chavez. She was elected to the Detroit School Board in 2009. She has served in exile, and we'll explain that in a minute, since the imposition of an emergency manager in the year 2009. That's the person who was appointed by the governor, who has the power, of course, to dissolve school boards and appoint a manager and other people to run school districts. Last year, she was sued by the state of Michigan, the attorney general, for being an elected official. We'll find out about that, too. She was recently arrested for protesting the city, for abrogating its public responsibilities pertaining to, for those of you who have been listening to the news, you know that Detroit water system is privatized, and the privateers have shut off the water to thousands of residents because they couldn't pay their bills. Also, the bills have been doubled, tripled, probably even more under privatization. That's the team that we will be talking with today. Welcome, everyone.
Let's start with
Dr. Pedroni. Tom, let's start with you. What we're talking about today is the theme that carries over from the first hour show is the state and fate of teachers' union in the wake of war on public education. You guys are in a state that is almost a ground zero battleground. The governor has done just about everything that he could do to destroy the union, taking over school districts throughout the state, and under the takeover, they're shutting down schools, they're getting rid of teachers, and the whole nine yards. What's it like there? You guys are
well,
there?
Well, I... I will go ahead now. It is like a war zone, and I think that your title of War Report for your show is actually a very apt metaphor for what we're seeing right now. I mean, who would have known that a city that has been a first in so many things in our nation, really the world, in terms of building a working class, having some minimum level of equity, having such powerful radical union movements and so on, would be facing the crisis conditions that you just talked about in Detroit today. And education has really been a front line for that. As I'm sure you'll hear from the others too, Detroit has lost over 200 of its public schools just in the last 12 years. No other city has had that sort of devastation. The elected school board on which Elena Arado serves has not had any of its power for 12 of the last 15 years because of the two state takeovers. The first, which you correctly spoke of, Ms. Helen Moore filed a lawsuit with Rosa Parks against that takeover. There was a very brief period for about 2 or 3 years when the district was handed back to the electorate, but they were handed back a district that was in chaos, that there were financial problems, the test scores were plummeting, people were leaving the district en masse. And then a few years later, the district was opportunistically taken over again. And what we've seen is all the hallmarks of the war on schools, the war on the public sector in education, the war on, especially on communities of color, low-income communities of color, like in Detroit and Philadelphia and other cities. We've had Teach for America teachers placed into our schools. And we have a separate district, which Elena Arada correctly calls the Jim Crow district, that is completely African-American and Latino, populated mostly by teachers who have absolutely no experience, most of them Teach for America teachers who went to summer camp for 5 weeks. So we're really at war for the city right now. And, of course, the way that politics plays out in the United States, the people who have stood by the city for so long, who have helped to make the city so rich in the first place, are blamed for the current condition. We have a Republican governor, but many Democrats have bought into the same narrative of decline, blame not on white flight, not on industrial flight, but rather on the people who remain there and live there, and who are actually the source of its wealth and its inspirational nature, which still exists there today.
That's a mouthful, but it's right on target. Ms. Moore,
yes.
You've been in Detroit for a while. I want to stop for a moment and let everyone know that today is Mrs. Moore's birthday. And she...
Happy birthday, Helen.
Thanks,
Happy
Elena.
Happy birthday, Helen.
Thanks, all of you.
I'm going to go a little further. Happy birthday to you.
Oh, my.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday,
happy
dear.
Happy birthday, dear Helen Moore.
Happy birthday to you. Da, 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 da.
All right.
Obviously.
That sounds good. Thank you very much.
Obviously, I have no career in music.
Especially
so.
Since I'm a music director for the choirs. Your voices are interesting, okay?
Okay.
It's called monotone, okay? Okay.
I told you, I'm either tone deaf or I have something.
I love it. So the thought
okay.
is what counts.
Okay. Ms. Moore, I'm gonna take another moment or two to go personal, one-on-one with you.
Okay.
You moved to Detroit as a little girl. What
right.
year?
In 1941.
Okay.
I was 3 years old.
Okay. Now, in 1943, there was a very famous race riot.
Right.
Not a riot, a race riot.
Yep.
You got caught up in that.
Sure did.
Tell
as a little girl.
Tell us about that, because
I
have something I want to tell you.
Okay. I was at Cheney School. My dad brought us up here from Tennessee, Newport, Tennessee. My whole family, five children, and my mother. He was working at Ford. So he came up, and we lived on Buchanan Street, and it was one big apartment that had about four black families in it. The rest of the community was all white. We had to go across Buchanan to Cheney School, and unbeknownst to us, while we were in school, a riot broke out, something about a white woman being thrown into the Detroit River out there at Belle Isle, and everyone started rioting. Well, we're children, we're in school, and it's only a few blacks in the school. So we get ready to leave. I remember this so vividly. We get ready to leave, and the principal runs and chains the doors and says, you can't leave. And so my brothers and sisters and the families that live with us, the children that live with us in our apartment, we were all standing behind the door while it was chained, and we looked out. We saw all of these white people with guns and clubs, et cetera. And we were really frightened, but as we looked out, we noticed how angry they were and how they were calling us all kinds of names, including the N-word, and we didn't understand what was going on. The principal told us, there's a riot going on, and you got to stay in, and all of you stay together, and he protected us. I really remember this principal very well. Well, we were there, 3 o'clock came, and 6 o'clock, we were still standing at the door looking out while these people were hollering at us, calling us names. Down the street comes my father with several men from the apartment building. They had shotguns across their shoulders, and they came through the crowd, and they came to the door, and they said, get back. And the principal opened the door and let us out, and my father took us through the neighborhood, but not the usual way home. We had to go a way around through another neighborhood was mostly Latinos, and we had to go through that neighborhood around the white neighborhood in order to get home. And that was an experience in my life that I'll never forget, and I think it had a bearing on the way I am today over justice and civil rights and education. I really think that's what happened. But after that, here's what really got me. I went to the first grade the following year, and there were two of us in the classroom, both named Helen. One was white and one was black. I'm the black one. So we get our report cards, and on the report card, it said that I failed. And I knew I hadn't failed. So this was kind of a new teacher, and I took the report card home and showed it to my mother and father, and they said, "Oh, that's terrible." And I said, "But that's not my grade." And my mother and father, because of the riot and because of the way things were that at that time, said, "That's all right. We know how smart you are." So I said, "But you got to go to school, tell my teacher, that's not my grade." And they refused to do it because in those days, they didn't want a challenge, okay? But I'm 6 years old at that point, and I go to school, and I walk up to the teacher, and I say, "Miss so-and-so, you gave me the wrong grade." She looked down at me. I said, "That's not my grade. I know what my mark should be." She looked at it and said, "You know what? You're right. That's the other Helen's grade." And I went home all joyful and jumping up and down, and my mother and father looked at me and said, "I don't know what we're going to do with this girl." But she, at 6 years old, settled the problem. I wasn't going to be satisfied with her failed grade. So now you know what motivates Helen Moore.
Let me tell you a story. Tom told me about this, and it triggered something that I hadn't thought about in 60-plus years. I was born in 1943.
Okay.
My mother and father moved up from southern Illinois to Detroit so that my father could work during the war there. When my mother was pregnant with me when the race riots broke out,
yes.
Like you, she didn't know anything about it. We lived very close to downtown at that time on Lafayette,
yes.
Orleans.
Yes.
My mother left home to go down to Sam Cutrate. You probably remember Sam Cutrate.
I do remember Sam Cutrate. That's right.
That was the first big department store at the edge of downtown.
Yes.
She gets halfway there, and the policeman comes up, and he stops her. She's walking. He stops her.
Oh.
And he tells her she can't go any further. And my mother being, you don't tell her what to do sort of thing, she insisted on going anyway. He blocked her way, and he started basically pleading with her not to go any further.
Mm-hmm.
What my mother didn't know was the riot had just broken out.
Oh, yeah.
And white men were killing men, women, children.
Yes.
On the spot. And she was about to walk into harm's way. He sent her back home. And she stayed in the house until it calmed down the next day or two, where it was. She told me this story and others, you know, for a while, but I hadn't thought about it until just when Tom mentioned it, and it triggered my experience there. We have had some very interesting connection. And by the way, my father also worked at Ford Motor Company.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
Yeah,
local
and I can probably find other connections with you and et cetera. Okay, now let's get to the subject at hand. Tom, you've given us a very good overview of what's happening on the ground there in Detroit from your point of view. Elena, you've been in Detroit how long?
I was born here in 1957. My parents worked in Detroit.
All right. Over the years that you've been there, what has happened in terms of the unions losing their influence, their power? Because this war on public education is just a part of the larger war in terms of trying to destroy unions, period. What has been your observation?
Let me say that the war on public education is legitimately a war. The attack on labor is something different because in order for there to be there really hasn't been a fight. The labor movement in Michigan in the last year in the lame duck session lost and got right to work in Michigan. Let me try to just lay out for you some realities in Michigan and Detroit. under the emergency manager law, which the people repealed, and we still have, every black city in Michigan is under some sort of takeover, whether it's receivership or emergency management. Detroit is the district, the school district was separate from the city, and there are forces trying to push it under what's called mayoral control so that it will be under the mayor as well. Detroit, the city of Coleman Young, which is 85% African-American, has a white mayor who was supposedly elected on a write-in campaign because he didn't live in the city long enough to be on the ballot. So the labor capital of the U.S., which is Detroit, is now in a state that has right to work. And the city of Coleman Young has a white mayor. In order to be able to understand this, you have to understand the complexities of campaign finance and political betrayal, because it couldn't have happened without the assistance of a lot of people who should have been fighting it. The fact that we are under emergency manager in Detroit Public Schools is reflective of a class and race reality that we have here. White people do not mind Detroit, Benton Harbor, Flint, Pontiac being under emergency manager because those are black cities. There is a gubernatorial election coming up in November that you barely hear the fact that black people in the state of Michigan have been stripped of voting rights. You barely even hear that discussion at all. So the racialized aspect of this is what's defining everything. The stripping away of public education is so dire in Detroit and in Benton Harbor and in Flint. Highland Park actually is the subject of a lawsuit because I think there was not one person in the district who was reading at grade level. So the ACLU actually took the case for Highland Park, which promptly handed itself off to a chartered district, so it became privatized. Now, if you can't talk about the issues at all without talking about race. There is definitely an element of class to it, but race rules all of it. And that's what's the most important thing to understand about the takeover of Detroit Public Schools and why it's been allowed to continue, but why nobody's talking about kicking out the emergency manager on September the 29th when his 18 months is up, and we've been under him for 67 months.
Helen?
Yes.
The suit that you and Rosa Parks filed in 99,
yes.
That was to stop the takeover.
Yes, it was. This suit came up, Public Act 10, enacted by the legislators. And it was to put in an appointed board. And they called it the Detroit Public School Reform Board, six of whom were appointed by the mayor of the city of Detroit, who was the defendant in our case, and that was Dennis Archer. So we were displeased with taking democracy away. And at that point, our education system was actually going up because all of us had sat down, all stakeholders had sat down and decided that we have to do something, and we came up with a plan which was called the Four Cornerstones. And it dealt with every issue that a child in the city of Detroit would confront, educationally, social, and all of that. And we were real pleased with it. And after a while, I have the article, when people say the system was not doing well, the article says Detroit Public School Achievement Soars. That was the headline in one of the main papers. But we were up against a 1994 bond issue where we had in our treasury $1.5 billion. And everybody wanted it, including the governor, Governor Engler, who had friends who were contributors to his campaign, and they wanted that money, and they were Barton Mallow. But the board, the elected board, before they appointed a board, had decided, we're going to give this money to Detroiters and to construction companies that were predominantly black. That didn't go well. So Engler decided, Okay, we got the only way we will get control of that money is to take over the school system. And that's when Rosa Parks and all of us got together and filed the lawsuit that went all the way to the Supreme Court.
And the outcome?
The outcome was this. Supreme Court decided, well, listen, there was a case before you in the Sixth Circuit, which was, since it was Cleveland, Ohio, that came before us, on the same thing to take over their school system, but they were 35% black, while we were 85% black. And the court in that case, there was already a finding in that case, said, well, look, if the citizens vote on it, then it's not really permanently taking away your rights. So they decided to let Cleveland vote on it, and they lost. They lost the vote. So we were sent back to Detroit feeling real bad, and we had a lot of publicity going, and we decided, okay, the mayor of the city of Detroit, which was Kwame Kilpatrick at that time, decided, well, he wanted mayor control too, so he came up with another act, Public Act 4. And that, every time we would win, by the way, they would change the law so they could continue control and controlling that money. So we came back to Detroit. It was on the ballot, and we voted, and we mobilized, and we did everything in our power. 67% of the city of Detroit was on our side, and we won. A few months later, they changed the law again, so that we were right back in the same position we were in before. They took our democracy away from us, and we have been fighting for years. Now we're under what they call 436, which is the same law. They just changed a few words on it to make sure that we did not get back control of an elected board in the city of Detroit. And that's where we are now, constantly fighting this issue and hoping it will end with the emergency manager that the governor controls and put in place over our educational system on September the 29th. We're holding our breath, but we're also fighting. We're planning to go to Lansing to present our story again to the State Board of Education. So we never stop fighting.
You know, as I said, I'm from Detroit. When I was in Detroit, we had, well, first of all, the schools were integrated.
Yes.
And in the 40s, I don't know exactly when, but they were certainly integrated when I started kindergarten. And that was due to a very large part by Walter Ruta and the union. He pushed for school integration. And it was there for me when I started school. Through school, most of the schools that I went to were predominantly white, with few blacks. There was one period in my life when I call it our gypsy years, when I was 7 to 10, where we went to schools that were predominantly black. But at 10, I moved into the east, what then was considered far east side of Detroit, and the schools there were predominantly white. For me, all the way through from the fourth grade to 12th grade, and our number one school there was Cass Technical High.
Yep.
It was considered a model school, not only for the city, for the state, but for the country.
Right.
And for a public school. I went to Southeastern High. And Southeastern High was considered only second to Cass during those years. Oh, by the way, I started off at Cass. I went there 2 days, talked my mother and letting me come back to the neighborhood school because it was a girl that I liked. And I said it to her at the time. And so I had a chance to go both to Cass and to Southeastern High. I know I keep up with Detroit as best as I can from the 2,000 plus miles that I'm away from Detroit. And Tom, you hit it for me right on the head. For a city and a state that was union who set the tone for Illinois, Wisconsin, Iowa to some extent, Minnesota, all the Midwestern, Ohio, with maybe the exception of Indiana, and for Pennsylvania, to wake up and see that Michigan is now a right-to-work state. It hurts me to no end, because I know what that means. Also, to see that there's this lawsuit that is making its way through the courts there so that people can opt out of the union. Oh, and by the way, this past month, August, was that a special period for opting out? Can anyone answer that?
Yeah, yes. We have a right-wing foundation here called the Mackinac Center, which is funded by some very far-right folks called the DeVosses, our wealthiest people. They're the local Koch brothers, I guess you could say. And they fund this Mackinac Center, which calls itself a free market center. I'd be critical of that, too, but I really think what they are is that they're an advocate for the interests of wealthy corporations, and they use free market ideology to beat people over the head with. But they have been promoting not only right to work, but have now been publicizing with the complicity of our daily newspapers, especially the Detroit News, to get the word out as much as possible about the August opt-out. I wouldn't even speak about it, except that today's August 31st, and I don't think we can do too much more damage since it's also a Sunday. But that is going on, and they have been very vocal about that campaign.
I'm confused. Is it a time limit for this opt-out? 30 days, 2 weeks,
yeah,
or a month, or is it saying any day, 365 days, you can opt out?
My understanding is that the teachers' union allows only the month of August when members can withdraw. So I guess August is when you are renewed for another year.
Yes, that's right. I read that. And then it's also something about a year in advance or something. But anyway, so today is the last day that you can opt out. Any sense of how many people are opting out?
I don't have that. No, I don't know.
Helen?
Yes.
Elaine, any idea?
No, I haven't heard a word about it.
Yeah, okay. Me either. That's kind of dead. It's not dead, but it's kind of undercurrent with the water and the schools and schools starting back and all the other issues that are facing the pensions and all that, Detroit. So I really haven't gotten that information, but we do need it. You know, today is the last day.
There was a very archaic proposal to cut the teachers' salaries by another 10%, which would have been the third 10% cut since 2011 for the teachers, and an increase of classroom size up to 43 students. And it was nixed at the last minute, but I would imagine that there would have been a lot of opting out had that gone through, because people wouldn't be able to afford to pay any dues, and they would probably also be wondering why they would. But I don't think that the opt-out was on the table or being discussed when that proposal was able to be pushed back. This was
the
last
union's week. There. What's left of it?
Well, there's less
teachers
than 4,000 members in the DFT now, we hear.
Right. 4,000.
From about from a high of how much?
About 20, about in the 90s and 80s, 20,000 down to 12,000 as they close all these schools. Now it's down to 4,000.
Let me say something about that, though, because the political aspect of this is very important. The first takeover, which occurred in 99, the union, the teachers' union and the school personnel unions related to the Michigan Federation of Teachers, supported the takeover of the Detroit Public Schools, which is in effect saying that they support the notion that parents cannot vote for their school board members. The parents lose their voting rights over the governance of our schools. The teachers union supported that in exchange for protection for their members. So there's a history of sort of a disconnect between the teachers union and the residents of the city of Detroit. And the teachers have never had a residency requirement in the Detroit Public Schools, so many of them don't live in Detroit, and many of them don't have children in Detroit Public Schools. There is a lot of meaning to the fact that people live in places where they don't live where they teach, and that their children aren't in the schools. And I think that really does resonate a lot in the city of Detroit, as such an incredibly segregated city that we are. So it's important to understand the political dynamics between the labor movement in the city of Detroit.
Yes, I'm from Detroit. I didn't mention that while I was in grad school at Wayne, I did sub for the school system. And Helen and I even end up teaching at Southeastern High as a sub, my old high school. When I was there, of course, as you mentioned, with the 20,000 plus, we had probably something close to that number in terms of teachers. The union was pretty much in lockstep with the automobile unions in terms of being more aggressive in terms of their negotiation of contracts and protecting themselves and et cetera. I am surprised that that has gone by the wayside over the years. I mean, I know I'm an older guy and it's been a lot of years have passed, but that is surprising and also very hurtful. I don't know if any of you listened to the first hour. I had Dr. Lois Wiener on and Mary Compton. Lois is here in New York and Mary's in England, London. And they're both union people, and we've talked about what I call the threat to external and internal threats to our teachers' union, raising the question of are the unions are going to be able to survive given the humongous impact this war from corporations, the President of the United States, his Secretary of Education, Ernie Duncan, all the way down, is putting on the unions, causing some friction inside the union. And one of the things I think you said, Elena, about the unions being more or less in the game looking out for themselves and not looking out for the community, the kids, parents, the social unionism that sweeping across the country, teacher organizations, where there's a coalition of teachers, parents, students, and other community members coming together and fighting in a common battle against all kinds of issues. If I'm hearing from you, that's not happening in Detroit in terms of what's left of the teachers' union. The social unionism that is happening across the country. I'm assuming
I'm going to jump in here real quickly, if that's okay.
Yes.
This is Tom, and I'm just going to jump in real quickly. I mean, I think people everywhere have been inspired by the social justice unionism that has taken place in places like Chicago. I'm not saying that CORE and Karen Lewis have been perfect, but the way that CORE came to power within the Chicago Teachers Union was very inspiring, and it was done by building relationships, as I'm sure you discussed with Dr. Wiener in the last hour and the other guests, through a very careful building of authentic relationships where the shared interests were really clear between the activists and the teachers' union. I think it was very much a rank and file movement, working together with community organizations like the Kenwood, Oakland community organization that G2 Brown plays an important role in. Those sorts of relationships are what have really inspired certainly the rank and file of the union movement, including maybe especially in education, in the rest of the United States. Now, that hasn't come to Detroit, and I think it could. There, you know, Detroit is not the same as Chicago. It's not the same as other areas, so there are some particular challenges. One of the challenges that remains, as Elena Arado was just discussing, is there is still great distrust, and for good reason. We still have not had unions that seem very interested in building momentum by working carefully and in true solidarity with local communities. And we've had a very clear example of that just recently that I learned about. One of the greatest fighters we have in the state legislature, and I'm going to have to use the past tense pretty soon and say we had, but one of the greatest fighters we've had is Ellen Kogan Lipton, who has been the leading voice, and there are other strong voices, but hers has been the leading voice in fighting, among legislators, in fighting the corporate takeover of education in Detroit, and in particular this Education Achievement Authority, which is this Eli Broad-funded district that's supposed to be statewide, but that is only in the city of Detroit with 15 schools, three of which they gave away to charters. She has been the one who has put so much of her own time and money into that to fight really passionately. She even spent $3,000 out of her own pocket for a Freedom of Information Act request to get information from the Education Achievement Authority that she needed to carry out her role on the House Education Committee, where she is the minority chair. So imagine that. Their role is to oversee and supervise, and they were considering a bill to codify and expand this entity, the Education Achievement Authority. And so in order to do her work, she requested information and was charged $3,000 for a jumble of information that she finally received. The point of the story is that that kind of worrier for education is really rare at a state legislative level. And she recently ran, because we have term limits in Michigan, she was term limited out of her House seat, and so she ran a campaign for a Senate seat. But there was an incumbent Democrat also in that seat. And the Michigan Education Association did not endorse Ellen Kogan Lipton. It endorsed her competitor because of some arcane processes within the union and how they make that sort of decision. But to lose Ellen Kogan Lipton when we are in such a dire circumstance already is really indicative to me and to many people of just how much work we still have to go to do in order to establish the kind of momentum that they have in Chicago. I mean, of course, that's exactly what we're trying to do, but it's a lot of work to do that. And I want to throw in one more thing, which will connect to you on a personal level. And I mentioned this briefly, James, when we spoke on the phone a couple days ago. Your school, Southeastern High School, is now part of that entity, the Education Achievement Authority. And not only is it part of that Eli Broad-controlled entity, but it is also colloquially known as the Teach for America High School, because it was handed over, basically, to Teach for America. Southeastern High School had, when it opened as an EAA school just 2 years ago, had 67% of its teaching force was first-year Teach for America, 5 weeks of summer camp, before going into some of the most challenging and underfunded and large class sizes in the United States. Not only were the teachers 67% Teach for America, but this school somehow could afford to do two principals, and we know the reason why is that the public taxpayers for Detroit were being put on the hook to fund this Teach for America experiment. So this school, unlike any other, was allowed to have two principals, one of whom was Jeffrey Maxwell from Teach for America Chicago, who, by the way, had a no-confidence vote by his Teach for America colleagues, passed nearly unanimously on him shortly after his term began. But the curriculum director of the school was also from Teach for America. Now, this school is notorious because while all of the Education Achievement Authority schools have lost tremendous population. Our emergency manager, who was appointed by Republican governor and DeVos friend Rick Snyder, he gave 15 schools away to the Education Achievement Authority in the midst of being under, the district itself being under emergency management. He gave away 15 schools in a state where per pupil funding that follows students is everything. Okay, so a huge hole in the Detroit Public Schools budget. And the district as a whole has already lost, since it was announced, since the schools that were going into it were announced, over 38% of its population. But it's way beyond that at Southeastern. Southeastern, in a single year, not even going back to when it was announced as an EA school, lost over 50% of its student population in both the 10th grade and the 12th grade, and lost the mid-40 percentile in the 9th grade. And just today, there's a scandal evolving where the Education Achievement Authority has been sending letters to parents in Metro Detroit, outside of Detroit. Again, this is a district established to fail kids, purportedly to help the poorest 5% of the schools in Michigan, of course. Again, they're all in Detroit. So letters were sent out telling, not advertising the EA, which would be pathetic enough if taxpayer money intended for our most vulnerable students.
I'm
going to
have to stop
market.
You because we're at our cutting off point. We have about a minute left. So okay. Let me just say this. First of all, thanks to each of you. This has been a very good conversation for me. I hope that we can get back together either individually or collectively as this group again, because I'm just riveted over what's happening to my city and my state. And for you, Helen, again,
yes,
happy birthday.
Thank you, James. It means so much for you to say that to me. Thank you.
And I would love to talk to you again and us talk about Detroit, because you and I have history there. Oh, I would love to talk to you.
Elena,
I would like to talk to you again as well. Tom, you know I'm going to talk
Helen
to you.
Moore?
Huh?
James, have you seen Helen Moore?
Yes.
Because Helen is really a stunning woman.
No, I haven't seen her, no. I'm just saying that...
She's a stunning, beautiful woman on top of being this warrior. And I have to also say, I don't know where we would be without her. I don't know where we would be without her. We wouldn't even be on our feet.
With that, we have to go. I hope to talk to each of you again, since I have your numbers, and possibly, again, have you on the show, either if it's just a call-in, just talk about something for a few minutes. Tom, you and I will be in touch. For the audience, see you in 2 weeks. Have a happy holiday, Labor Day holiday, and best wishes to all. Good evening.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.